Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Returning football shirts to the fans. Join the movement today by using hashtag Save Our Shirt.
You're following the rugby very closely, but we are coming for your boys in Yokohama on the 22nd of September, I tell you that much.
Yeah, well, we shall see about that. Scotland were okay against France at the weekend, so, you know.
Well, we're just rope-a-doping everybody in. Wait and you see the plan we're going to unleash. Oh, we've lost you. Pat Nevin gone? And with that, he's like...
That's what happens when you bring up rugby in a football segment.
I'm not talking rugby.
What the hell? You didn't come here for this.
We'll try and get Pat Nevin back.
This one's going to happen in a couple of weeks now. It's going to be rugby segues in every topic.
Well, when Pat Nevin from Scotland is on, it may come up, yeah.
I don't know. The rugby segue doesn't grab the Scottish nation in the same way it even might do here, really, does it?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not so sure.
Are you not?
I don't know. I'd see some of the... I've seen comments to the contrary now, yeah, in terms of... how to the extent, maybe Pat can clarify that, but really we should just get back on track and talk about football in the football section.
Well, we're going to talk to Pat about Arsenal-Liverpool. We'll bring you Kenny Cunningham. He was talking on OTB AM this morning. So Kenny here was talking to Owen and Jared this morning. This is a point we'll obviously get into with Pat. And, well, he gets on to David Luiz here. He was asked, were Arsenal in a better place this year?
No better for David Luiz's appearance at the football club. I was very surprised that Emery made that jump and brought him there. I know people said, 8 million, very experienced player, he ticked a lot of boxes, but not for me in terms of what Arsenal needs in the centre of that defence. They need somebody who knows how to defend, basically, and actually somebody who enjoys defending. And David Luiz never struck me as somebody who actually enjoys defending. His position for the tour, the Salah goal, it's almost unprecedented. You very rarely see a defending like that. The way Salah left him and left him 10 yards behind him running towards the edge of the 18-yard box. The only way you can get beat as a defender in a situation like that is that a forward actually drops his right shoulder to the ground and actually spins to the left and actually does it. You kind of fall for it and you get left behind. But if you watch Salah's movement, he doesn't even do that. All he basically does is lean, slows down and leans to the left and takes a quick touch. So to be left 10, 15 yards behind your man after a kind of simple bit of skill like that, it's unheard of. It's literally unheard of, and it's lazy defending, and it's typical of David Luiz, all or nothing. When it comes off and he wrestles the ball off the centre-forward and walks up the pitch with the ball, 40,000 people are off their seats clapping, brilliant defending. But unfortunately, the next two times it happens, he's chasing back towards the edge of his penalty box 10 yards behind his man. That's what I mean. It's all or nothing. When a man can stay on his feet, shift his feet, keep 2-3 yards goal side, have to move his feet and almost concede possession, allow your teammates time to recover around you, that's good defending. That's what you have to do nine times out of 10. And he doesn't do it. He doesn't want to do it for me. And for me, it's the last sign an Arsenal needed going into the season where they need to improve and become more solid defensive, particularly that central defensive area. I'd be amazed if he plays the whole season there, because these kind of problems are just going to multiply and continue all during the course of the season.
That was Kenny on OTBAM this morning. Pat, I'm told you're back with us.
I am on a different computer because my computer's blown up again.
So slightly unfortunately, that was going to be the ace in my back card when you started to defend David Luiz, and now you haven't heard Kenny's point on David Luiz, unfortunately. But you can imagine the gist of what he's saying.
I didn't hear any of it, but he was absolutely dreadful, would be pretty much up there. All the things that David Luiz does wrong, he did them wrong in that game. It was ridiculous. It was just him at his most impetuous, stupid, worst. I was talking to an Arsenal fan today and I was saying to him, with a bit of luck, that's all the stupid stuff out of the way now. Because he'll do it now and again in a season. But that was just ridiculous. I mean, the tug. I mean, and then having the cheek to argue with the ref about it was ridiculous. And then getting too close to Salah was just childlike. It was so ridiculous. And, you know, to see him doing that, he needs to get his manager back on top of him and make sure he gets his head screwed on again. We shall see. If he does that regularly, he won't be in the team. And he won't deserve to be in the team.
Because, you know, they're getting to... Look, the tug obviously was a very silly thing to do, and maybe on some level it was slightly instinctive and it was brilliant quick football and he knew he was beaten and he did it. But with the Salah thing, I mean, he totally beat himself. There was just no need to do it under the circumstances, the lack of cover he had. I mean, it's just a simple kind of basic thing there to make sure Salah knows that you have a 5-yard head start on him. and to sit back, and Sal will take a touch and lay it off, and there's no trouble. And we were, Dan and I were even saying in the news round, he didn't just half like sell himself and then kind of turn as soon as he realised he'd made the mistake. He completely sold himself, so he was completely out of the game, almost because he didn't fancy running back.
You know, and the simplest thing, there are certain types of players you don't get too tight to. You just don't do it. I mean, Aguero, don't get too tight to him. He will roll you. And then you know the players that are like that. And with bells on it, that is Mo Salah. And certainly don't do it when you're out wide. And that's a panicked player. He's gone out too wide. And because he's wide, he's not comfortable out there and gets too close. Look, hey, I'm not giving any excuses or reasons for that. It was rotten. And it really cost his team very, very badly. Because, you know, the one thing that you look at Arsenal, you think, that attacking area looks okay. You know, midfield probably has to improve a bit. But if they get the back sorted, then they've got a chance of getting top four. But if you defend like that, you've no chance. It was awful. It was horrible. And I give him no excuses. And that's not just because he's wearing red and white now.
it was a really good game to watch, really enjoyable game. And right from the off, the dynamics of it were set. You know, Arsenal had set up narrowly and surrendered the ball to Robertson and Alexander-Arnold out wide. And that was going to be the way they were going to do it. But there were glimmers of hope. Pepe in particular had a few moments, and Aubameyang was up top as well. And, you know, you're going to see how this whole thing was going to play out. Jurgen Klopp said he was a bit surprised Arsenal set up that way. And I suspect he sort of meant pleasantly surprised that they did surrender the wings to Robertson and Alexander-Arnold. What was your read on how Arsenal went about it? And I guess more to the point, why Emery decided to go for that tactic?
I think a lot of teams do go for that tactic. I mean, you don't expect it necessarily from Arsenal. I mean, Arsenal have gone three at the back quite a lot last season, even under Emery. But a lot of teams, what they'll do is they'll get the back line in place, and then they'll get the midfield really tight in front of them and say, right, you can have the ball out wide and just get through us, but you'll have to be a hell of a good to get through us. Now, they won't do that against many teams. They might do that against Man City. They might do that against Liverpool, but I wouldn't suspect they would do it against many teams. But, I mean, that's been done before. I mean, famously, that's what Jose did for Real Madrid against Barcelona. You know, he tried to make it, you have the ball out there all day long if you like, but you can only score from in the middle. But when they went, if you widen that at all and you get stretched at all, that's when players like Salah and, as I say, Aguero and a whole bunch of them, they will destroy you. And it takes a committed attitude, and it takes everybody to be completely dogmatic about the way you're going to set up against it to do that. And I watched plenty of teams do it. I watched Sheffield United do it recently. I mean, teams can come up and do that in the Premier League. It's not that complicated. Everybody's head has to be in the right place, and don't get carried away and don't get dragged out. And that's what Louise got dragged out for, that third goal, didn't it?
Mm. Gary Neville made the point on Sky that he's watched Arsenal at Anfield before in recent times, and he's questioned how much interest there was on their behalf. He's also found them very naive. He said on Saturday, this is just about quality. You know, and he said as 3-1 defeats, and it was 3-0 at the time, so he was almost laughing as he said it. He said as 3-0 defeats go, this actually isn't so bad for Arsenal.
I think most people just look at the league table already. I mean, Man City, Liverpool at the top there, and they're going to be like that. I don't think you gauge yourself against those two teams, even if you're Arsenal, even if you're Man United, even if you're Spurs, Chelsea, whatever. I don't think you gauge yourself with what happens necessarily against, you know, Liverpool and Manchester City, because you will do different things. You won't play your own game. You will be reactive. So, yeah, if you judge them by you should be as good as them too, then you give them dogs abuse. But I don't actually think they are. I don't think many people think they are. And clearly, Unai Emery doesn't think they are either. Mm. That's why they adapted so much to that game instead of playing their own game.
At the other end of the pitch, Adrian is injecting just a hint of jeopardy into Liverpool defending. There was a moment where Van Dijk was goal side and Adrian decided to kind of run out and get involved. And so that's just looming for them a little bit on the horizon. And I'm sure he'll be fine medium term and long term. Is Van Dijk like 2% less magnificent and wonderful than he might have been last season?
Well, somebody's actually got past him this season. So far, Pepe's actually managed to beat him. Is he the first player that's beaten him in 50 games or something like that? Got past him. I was actually having a discussion today. I'll bring both of you in this to see what you think. There's a young lad, I know, he's an Arsenal fan. And he was saying, somebody actually beat Van Dijk. Someone actually got the ball and got round him. That's amazing. That's incredible. And there can't ever be another player like that. And I said, well, actually, I think I remember two that I used to play against. That if you got round them, you actually remembered you got by them. Any guesses, guys?
Paul McGrath.
McGrath, he won, maybe.
Correct. By a million miles. I can remember doing him once, getting by him, scooting the ball, and Mickey Hazard scored a goal. I didn't care about the goal. I just thought, I'd done Paul McGrath. I was so happy about it because it was so hard to beat him. And to some degree, Des Walker was a bit like that
right. For
a period of time as well. But McGrath was closest, I think, looking when he's at his very, very best, closest to Van Dijk and being almost unbeatable. So you're gauging him by a very high standard, aren't you?
The
odd little bit. His biggest fear, having watched Van Dijk all the way through his career, is boredom. You know, if it gets too easy for him, he sometimes gets a little bit bored and starts doing silly fancy things. I don't think that's going to happen. I think he will be just his normal self. And he is adding those things to the game that I thought he would add. He's becoming much more dangerous in attacking. He's more dangerous at corners. And I'm just waiting for those free kicks to start raining in as well, because he's fantastic at them as well. I don't think it's time to worry about Van Dijk yet.
Yeah. What about Pepe then?
Yeah, funnily enough, I was at the game Arsenal up at Newcastle,
yeah,
and he only came on at the end, and he completely changed the way that Arsenal looked. But having, you know, a three-pronged attack, if you've got, you know, Aubameyang, Lacazette, and Pepe all running at you, which will happen at various times this season to various teams, that's frightening. That's really frightening, because each one of them can destroy you. Pepe, without a doubt, is probably up in that class as well, I would say. So if he's up in the class of Aubameyang and he adds goals to it as well, and his pace is ridiculous, so put all the things on top. The thing that I've not seen as much yet, which I kind of expect Arsenal fans will start enjoying, when some teams come out against them and you get that David Luiz ball over the top, it doesn't even need to be pinpoint anymore, because there's three of them now. Mm. Any one of those three can run onto it, and if there's any space beyond defences, those balls will destroy them, with Pepe being as good as the rest of them. But, you know, he's had a good, lively-looking start, but I've no doubt he'll get much, much better. He looks the real deal.
Yeah, I kind of wonder, Pat, do you think that Emery will use the three of them together often? I mean, I think he did it for 25 minutes towards the end of the previous week, and there was some talk he might do it on Saturday, and obviously he didn't. But I guess the question is, do they have the midfield quality or the stability behind to play that front three? Do you think that is the way he will go more often than not?
It's a great question, and I would hope for Arsenal fans he would, but as many Arsenal fans will tell you, last season when they were wanting to see Aubameyang and Lacazette playing together, they didn't. You know, a lot of times Lacazette was left on the bench, and you're thinking, well, wait a minute, I'm looking at it from an opposition point of view, you don't want to see that. You really don't want to see that running at you. So it's about him getting a group of players that are capable, you know. And if you look at, you know, the Liverpool method, that's quite interesting. They've got the three absolutely devastating attackers, and the midfield doesn't always look that exciting, you know, not even always that creative, but they're all workmanlike and they'll all do a job, and they're all very, very good players. And it may well be that that's what you do. You know, you get guys that are coming from wide areas, that's fine, you overlap them fullbacks, but the other seven players apart from those three, their first job is defend and stay tight, so that when the break happens, that those other three guys up top can do it. And that's kind of a lot of the time what's been happening with Liverpool. So there's no reason why Arsenal shouldn't do that sort of thing, because it works.
Mm. There would have been a time in recent enough history where Manchester United losing at home at Old Trafford to Crystal Palace would have been the first thing we'd come to, and what's gone on here, and give us your thoughts. And I guess what the last week maybe has just signified in that draw at Wolves and the loss at home is that even with the much talked about full pre-season that Solskjaer's managed to get into the players, they've quickly reverted to their average, to their kind of recent mean. This is just the team they are now. They are a pushing for top four, kind of bog standard, very beatable set.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think they're much more than that. That's pretty good, but do they look like a team that's going to get close to City and Liverpool? No, I don't see why that would be the case. They've added, obviously, Maguire, I think, makes a big difference. You have a bit of sturdiness there most of the time. That will help a little bit. Just not too sure if, you know, the money spent in Wan-Bissaka, that was a huge amount of money that they spent in Wan-Bissaka. So, you know, to do that in the fullback, you know, I'm not too sure, especially if you're talking about Arsenal just a second ago. They've still got Tierney to come in to that.
Mm.
And Tierney will make a massive difference to that, you know, what he creates going forward and how good a defender is. But You know, you, actually, Tierney would have been the one I would have went for if I was Manchester United manager and tried to get him. And it'd have been, what, much less than half the cost. Slightly different position, but for me, a far, far better player. Are there a team that's going to do much more than that? Well, I don't know. If you watched the game against Wolves in the first half, I thought they were really, really good.
Mm.
And you thought, well, if you keep up that standard, that's the big if. And they didn't. They absolutely didn't. They didn't control it at all after that. And they were, in the end, I think, quite lucky in the end of that game.
Yeah, like, I don't know. Like, what's the definition of a good season, Pat, for Manchester United now? Like, what's an acceptable return from the season? Because I think most people recognise that they're a bit off the top two. But what's good now? What is a good year?
Well, it's the same as everybody. It's just top four. That's all you're aiming for. You're nothing more than that. You're looking at Spurs. You're looking at... I don't say Chelsea yet because it shouldn't be Chelsea. But, you know, Manchester United, it should be. They've had that time. They've brought in the players they wanted to. Kind of a wee bit disappointed. I thought Martial would have done a wee bit more against Palace because a lot's saying for him. You know, but it's, you know, don't get too carried away with it. Yeah, if they're up fighting and close to the top four at the end of the season and getting Champions League football back at Old Trafford, I think that will be a kind of success for them. I mean, a half-decent cup team, but even then, would I be putting money on them winning a cup before, you know, City or Liverpool? No, I wouldn't be doing that either, so... It's not an abuse of Manchester United because I think plenty of Man United fans out there will feel exactly the same. Bog standards harsh, but they're not at the top of the tree yet. They're nowhere near.
Bog standard by Manchester United standards, maybe.
Yes.
What was so striking, I was saying to Dan that I was watching the Arsenal-Liverpool game and then Sky do a match of the day highlights, you know, like a condensed, you know, the full match into an hour. And it really was like flicking in, you know, like someone had just turned down the speed by a couple of notches. And the other thing which jumps out, especially when you compare games like that back to back, rotation, I suppose, is the modern day word for it. But you have that front three, Liverpool in particular, you know, zipping around in, you know, popping up in different areas and just people moving around. Like, it's hard really to overstate how static Manchester United look at various points. It's literally like someone has just copied and pasted the formation for them and they've just decided to go and stand in their spots. There just doesn't seem to be any spark. And I don't know how you inject a team with that.
You know, some clubs are just like that, and you'd have to ask Solskjaer about it because you've got players up front. I mean, Rashford's perfectly comfortable right attack, left attack, centre attack. Martial, exactly the same. So you should have that adaptability within that group. But clearly, it's not good enough to be able to do that. Or maybe he wants a little bit more static. He wants everybody to know where each other is. There is a little bit of you that also has come to the conclusion that, you know, this is new, Lukaku's gone. This is kind of the group that's going to go forward. They need to work out what each other does with each other. So give them a little bit of that.
But sure.
Like everybody else, you don't. Will Martial score a whole bunch of goals again? We all know that he scored more in the percentage games than Lukaku did. But will it be enough? I'm not sure. And I love him as a player. I think he could be a really good player. But is it going to be enough to get Manchester United in the top four? Well, a chance.
Yeah.
A good chance. Yeah. A decent chance.
You mentioned Chelsea there, Pat. I didn't think this was around the corner for me. I'm starting to like Chelsea.
I know.
I didn't think this was going to be on my horizon, but I'm really starting to like Chelsea. I like Frank. And then Tammy scored two. It made my Saturday.
First name terms with Tammy now. It's not even... Yeah, Tammy. He's just one of the lads now.
I was genuinely thrilled for Tammy. Mason Mount as well. I like what he's doing, especially he got criticism in the first game. Mourinho criticised him at Old Trafford and he's been playing very well.
Yeah.
Pulisic, Barkley, you know, there's just a certain kind of charm about them. And most of all, I like that they have no game management, it seems, Pat. Like, if you're watching Chelsea now, you're in for a good time.
I keep on saying, from the start of the season, before the first game, first ball was kicked, this is going to be exciting.
Yeah.
Really exciting with Chelsea. And it will be exciting, and it will not change. That's the way Frank approaches it. That's the way he wants his teams to play. He wants them to play with that energy. Now, the odd thing is, the game I was down against Leicester, for 25, 30 minutes, they were absolutely unbelievable. The speed of it was incredible. And I kept on asking the question, how long can you keep this up? Actually, the answer was 35 minutes. But that was early on in the season. They will get better and better. And because they've got... It's that youthfulness, isn't it, that you love? You love that, you know, intensity and the love of playing it that they've got. Tammy's a big one for me because I've been here for a long time, watched him coming through, you know, talked about Solanke, all the players that come through. It was always Tammy for me. He was the one that was going to be the one that could be extra special.
Yeah.
But there's a bit here of looking at it now, and Pulisic, I've got a lot of time, but he's a lovely player to watch, and he will improve. He oddly enough, even though he cost, was at £58 million,
yeah,
pounds,
yeah,
he's underestimated by people, and he shouldn't be. He's going, and I still don't think people have seen his startling pace as much as when they start seeing that, they're going to be stunned by that as well. He's a very, very intelligent player, and he also does some stunning tricks. So the thing that a lot of Chelsea fans are beginning to see now, at some point in this season, you're going to see a front line. Let's get Mason Mount left, Tammy up front, Hudson-Odoi on the right, and probably Ruben Loftus-Cheek coming from behind. And whereas if you stuck that on, you know, the Chelsea team last season, it would be for a meaningless kind of Carabao Cup game that they didn't really care about. You stick that team out now and you're thinking, whoa, wait a minute. Could be really, really good and really exciting. It is, right, I have to say, I'm trying really hard not to get carried away. Like myself, I'm enjoying it. Remember, they are young and there will be ups and downs, but it's a joy to watch just now. And Mount's a lovely player to watch. By the way, I don't know if you watched much of the Norwich play just now, Cantwell, is it? Have you seen him?
Not much.
Jack Cantwell, yeah.
He's a bit special as well. He won't be at Norwich for long. But yeah, great for Chelsea. Really exciting times.
Well, like maybe they should just slap like a transfer ban on every club for a while and force them to go into their youth ranks and maybe take a chance on players who they might not feel are quite ready, or players who will get nowhere near it if money could be spent. Because there's a bit of a journey about the whole thing. There's a certain charm about it. There's a kind of, it's a bit more organic and real as opposed to parachuting in, you know, like Higuain. Do you know what I mean? That would sap my soul, Higuain being signed to replace Tammy because they know he'll get them 18 goals a season. I've no interest in that in many respects. Whereas watching Tammy...
I feel like you're growing closer to Tammy, even just in your language here. He's on first name terms.
And he
like
has
it.
No idea. But I'm invested in Tammy. Do you know that way? And I think fans, and as you said, they have give it a bit of leeway. They understand what's going on here. Like, it could be a really nice thing.
Yeah. Somebody wrote in the paper, the newspaper, yesterday morning, Chelsea fans feel as if they've got a club back. And you know exactly what you mean by that. And the Chelsea fans, I mean, they are hyper about it. They actually, this is the oddest thing, Chelsea win trophy after trophy, year after year after year. And you know what? They don't win anything this year, they don't care. Because they've got what they feel is something that really belongs to them. So they're invested in it as much as anybody else. They're backing the player. The Tammy thing, because it's a brilliant story for a multitude of reasons, you know, waiting for him to come through all this time. The fact that he missed that penalty against Liverpool in the Super Cup, there was some racially vile comments online, some keyboard warriors. The club were right down on them pretty quick as well, and so were the fans as well. And the fact that the fans were straight on behind him and Frank stuck right by him as well. So all of that, it seems like a story that's just started. It's not. It's a story some of us have been desperate to see coming through for quite a long time. I have to say it's coming a lot quicker than I thought. And with Tammy, I think the simple thing is, when you look what Higuain scored last season, you look what maybe Batshuayi would score, what Giroud would score, do you think, given the opportunities, Tammy Abraham would score less goals than them? No, he wouldn't. He would score as many of them. So why not give him a chance?
Like that excitement you've had about Tammy over the last couple of years, Pat. Like, I know he's had three loan spells, and I know he was like, he was sensationally good at Aston Villa. Like, but has he evolved as a player over that time compared to maybe the expectations that there were when he was a kid initially at Chelsea? I mean, have you seen him grow over that time, or is there still a lot more to come?
Do you know, you're saying grow when you mean as a player, you know, and as an individual and his charisma and having the big number 9 on his back. Do you know what? It's something simple in that. It's physical growth. He actually was just a little bit too wiry. You know, the frame hadn't filled out. And it happens now and again with players. They just suddenly, something happens. And they, you know, it's more than just the actual physical filling out. They believe in their physique as well. And Tammy's getting close to that. And he's going to get bigger and bigger and stronger. And he's going to believe in that strength. It's a bit like, you know, talking about that, you know, loving watching these players come through. And, you know, it's a transfer ban that causes it. But remember what happened to Rashford? Same sort of thing, wasn't it? He only got a chance because of a whole bunch of injuries.
Yeah.
I mean, you had to put him in. So what it is, if you're a young player, you've got to be ready. That's what it is. It's just you've got to be ready when the opportunity comes. what's nice about Chelsea is, for the first time in forever, they've got A, a manager, and B, a club that's saying, we don't mind, it's okay, we'll give you time. And it's amazing to see, because you couldn't see this before, because it was all about winning. I get a feeling Roman Abramovich has said, right, we've won plenty, I want to get entertained as well now. He's been saying that for quite a few years. He's getting it now, and I think he'll be loving it whenever he gets the chance to get to a game, that is.
Yeah, well, that's a good point as well. Pat, we're just out of time, unfortunately. I did want to ask you about Spurs, but we'll do that next week, potentially, and see how they get on at the weekend.
Yeah, Thanks Eriksen's enough. Still there. That's
yeah.
The big thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true, yeah. Thanks a million. We'll see you next week.
See you then.
All Cheers. Right. Pat and Evan there. The Football Show. On Off the Ball. With Paddy Power. Join the Save Our Shirt movement today. More at saveourshirt.co.uk. I'm prepared to anything I can. Well, do it then. Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Now then, you're welcome along to the Football Show. We will have some Brian Kerr for you later on. He was at Spurs 0, Newcastle 1 yesterday for us. We do have live commentary every Sunday now of the Premier League, and as we have done for years at this stage. And of course, more Dan McDonald. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Joe, again.
How are we doing?
Yeah.
So a few bits and pieces. You were watching New Wonder Kid at Barcelona against Real Betis last night. Ansu Fati at the age of 16, 298 days.
16.
Came on as a substitute. Yeah, he was born in October 2002, Dan.
Oh, God. What were you doing then, Joe?
Leaving cert.
Leaving cert?
October.
In October? Oh, is your leaving cert year?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Still trying to get to grips with what had happened in Saipan, I suspect. Yeah, trying to get my little head around that.
You're still in school, still struggling. Oh, yeah, so of course, it would have been, Ireland-Switzerland, which is obviously next Thursday, the Ireland-Switzerland game that did for McCarthy. Well, I mean, this was the writing was on the wall. But that was, I think it might have been October 2002. I think I vaguely recall watching it in the student bar in UCD. So there you go. But yeah, Barcelona, the good thing about Barcelona is that it was on ITV4. It's back on Irish TV screens. So not accessible to everyone, but accessible to quite a few people, I think, now. So, it was good to have Barcelona actually back on the telly, because they were missing pretty much last year.
I'll come to that in a few moments' time. Brian Kerr will talk Spurs 0, Newcastle 1. We've already had Pat and Evan on the show. If you're one of those types that tunes into the radio at 9 o'clock to hear Pat and Evan on a Monday, we had him on at 7:30. Podcast listeners, you'll have just heard him. So, Brian Kerr does talk FAI business as well as Spurs 0, Newcastle 1. This was another Sunday Times. Well, there were various, actually, stories in the Sunday Times, but the one which made the front page of the main section concerned issues around the John Giles Foundation, I suppose is the best way to put it. FAI paid Giles pal €300,000 for a walk idea. I appreciate there's probably lots of people who listen who haven't read this piece and are vaguely aware of it. So maybe just to tease through some of the main pieces of reporting, and then you can give your thoughts on it. FAI paid pal Giles pal €300,000 for walk idea is the headline. In basic terms, the pal they're talking about is Con Martin, who's a former League of Ireland player. The payments were made across 2011 to 2016, so about 60k a year over those 5 years. This was at a time, obviously, when there were pay cuts happening in the FAI initially. Now, what seems to have happened here is, in so much as I can tell, because this piece raises questions as much as gives all the answers, I would say. That's my overriding sense from it. You come away with a number of queries and trying to extrapolate what exactly is what. So basically, it seems Con Martin said he signed a contract with the FAI in 2008. He had been running the John Giles Golf Classic for 8 years, and he says that Giles approved of him setting up a foundation that the FAI then bought from him, the foundation being the John Giles Foundation. And as part of all this, you know, we would have seen from 2011 territory or so, there was a walk to raise money, the Walk of Dreams. So it's Con Martin's contention that he owns the copyright and the intellectual property when it comes to the Walk of Dreams, and also the team kitwear idea, which proposed clubs combining their purchasing power to secure discounts. Now, in a board meeting, November 2016, an FAI board meeting, and really the basis of much of Mark Tye's reporting over the last number of weeks and months has been minutes of various FAI board meetings. So at a board meeting in 2016, Martin said he had been told by John Giles that the FAI sold the Walk of Dreams concept to UEFA for €10 million. The FAI, by the way, did not respond to questions from the Sunday Times, and last night UEFA said that after an initial investigation, it could find no record of the alleged agreement with the FAI, but that was Martin's understanding, courtesy of Giles, that this concept had been sold for €10 million. Now, his issue with the FAI is, as he puts it himself, "I lost my head because I said that he, John Delaney, had the rights for the Republic of Ireland only, but that I had the copyright and the intellectual property for the rest of the world." That's Martin's understanding of the situation. Now, at this board meeting in 2016, the board was told that the end game, because initially it was queried, basically the €300,000 over these number of years was queried by the board. And the word from John Delaney was that stopping this payment, these payments, would be, quote, hard to achieve. The board was told that the end game, quote, end game, was, quote, not giving Martin any more money, but, quote, this would be hard to achieve. And then Delaney said he was going to be meeting John Giles to discuss the issue. And we don't know what happened then. We don't know, did the €300,000 come courtesy of the FAI coffers or courtesy of the John Giles Foundation coffers? Again, this asks more questions than it does give answers. Obviously, it's fine reporting. That's not a criticism of the piece by any means. I'm just making the point that you come away not quite sure the full picture. So Martin confirmed this weekend he did get 60 payments of €5,000 between 2011 and 2016. And he said the payments were for the Giles Foundation, the Walk of Dreams, and a concept called Team Kitwear. And that's his understanding of how things have transpired. That's where we are. Your initial reaction to the piece, it's part of a drip, 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 drip situation.
Yeah, like, you know, that piece, as you mentioned, the Mark Tye and Paul Rowan piece, like, it would have been very, like, obviously carefully written, you know, as you mentioned, like, it does appear that leaked board minutes are the centrepiece of sort of the more recent stuff, you know, a lot of the very recent stuff. So, you know, those minutes, I suppose, speak for themselves, and people sort of have to pick through it. And as you mentioned, like, it's you can't necessarily just speculate about what this or that means, but there's a couple of things where you're like, well, it's imploring you to think about it and to consider it. You know, my broader point in this is
that you wrote about this today.
Yeah, my broader point in this would be that I wonder now with the public, to a degree, how much the detail even matters now. The detail is all important. Don't get me wrong. Every bit of detail is vital in terms of the history of this, and for unpicking everything that's happened, and, you know, to learn or to get to the bottom of everything. That's vital. But I do wonder the extent to which the public now are just, well, here we go again. You know, it's another story, whatever about the subject matter, where on paper it's, you know, sums of money being paid by the FAI to an individual. And we've seen that pattern with a lot of stories that have come out over, you know, a payment to this person and that person. Mm-hmm. And this has coincided with a time when I think it's been pretty well documented over a long period of time that the FAI's finances were a period, you know, or a source of some concern. It was denied emphatically again and again by people from the FAI and official channels at AGMs and stuff, and even for FAI staff members, and I think even the most relevant reaction to a lot of this has been from people who have worked in the FAI and people who are involved with clubs, who would have gone to meetings either as employees or as, you know, club officials or representatives, and they would have been told, well, no, your pay cuts can't be restored because of this, or you can't do this because of this, or you know, your prize money is this size because of this, and we can't afford any more. And then people see sort of eye-watering amounts of money appearing in a very unusual context that is broadly under the umbrella of the FAI. And I think that really, like, this is just devastating as it keeps happening in terms of what it's doing to the brand, I hate the term, but the brand and the reputation of the FAI. Because I think a lot of people now, I think if you walk down the street and just said to a lot of people, what comes to mind when you think of the FAI? and they will. I'm pretty sure a lot of them will have. Oh yeah, you know the kind of response that you're going to get. But like, here we go again.
Yeah.
And I think that even this is the problem now with the, and they've used the term themselves, so I'm not calling it myself. But the new FAI is almost, it's almost been an attempt to portray the reform and the governance review reform of recent months as well. This is the new FAI now, and there is a new board and a new structure. And I'm not saying there wasn't good stuff in those reforms. There is. You know, there are some important changes there that are good. But really, you're just going to wonder, are they just fighting a losing battle here? They're fighting a losing battle with perception, because anything that comes out now is diminishing their attempts to move forward. And that's because there's a crossover of people and characters and personalities that are still there.
Yeah.
And the perception of the FAI, like, you kind of wonder, is it irreparably damaged? Like, that was the point I made. Like, look, this stuff is all, I mean, okay, what does this mean, right? But a couple of months back, there was a suggestion that, like, would you nearly have to, like, go with a new name, a new logo, almost like a new entity? You know, obviously, the complications with that in terms of, you know, your membership of associations, but, you know, just to go for a complete rebrand and a new image. The OCI did it. They had to do it because the OCI was synonymous with something. And the FAI is now becoming synonymous with something to the same degree, with like massively negative connotations. And like, it actually doesn't seem that mad and far-fetched now, that you just wonder, like, that changes that are happening now under the umbrella of the FAI.
Yeah.
Like on Thursday week, we're going to have a game against Switzerland in the Aviva Stadium, sort of mentioned earlier, that, you know, this is like, you know, you get the programme, it's the FAI, it's the, you know, it's the same organisation. It's some different people. Actually, some of the people that I mentioned are still being paid by the FAI as well. So, like, John Delaney is still on the payroll of the FAI. So, I mean, that in itself is a massive, as much as the reviews are ongoing and we need to figure out what happened, and I understand that there's due process there, and I get all of that.
Yeah.
But it's impossible for the stench to lift.
Yeah.
While this information about the recent past just keeps coming out and coming out and coming out.
And it strikes me, unfortunately, I initially thought the rebrand idea was a bit unnecessary.
So,
but
right,
as time goes on, I've come around to your way of thinking that actually the FAI, as you said, if you walk down the street now, represents one thing when you talk to people. I suppose the crucial difference between the OCI rebrand and where the FAI is that the OCI board was completely, I don't want to say they were all fired, because that wasn't the case, but we now have a completely new OCI board, and with the FAI, we absolutely do not. We have Donald Conway in there still for another year against the wishes of the Minister for Sport. We have various other people still involved. Niall Quinn, there was a report in the Sunday Times Sports section yesterday, is disappointed that there are 8 internal appointments. He understood it was going to be 6 to the board.
Well, what's happened is that there's 8 people appointed to the board already, yeah, and there's 4 independent directors are going to join. Yeah. But because, for example, the 8 FAI people that were elected through FAI, the FAI parish as such,
yeah,
because they were all male, there's also, and this isn't necessarily representing Niall Quinn's position, but obviously the independent directorship candidate, they need to address the gender balance there, whereas the FAI hasn't addressed the gender balance within its own constituency as such. And just the process of portraying this as the brand new board is, it's slightly compromised under a number of headings.
The net point is this: with the OCI board and the rebrand, there was a clear out which coincided with the rebrand. There's no point the FAI changing its name now and all these characters still involved, because nobody will buy it. That's the difficulty they face.
I think I probably agree with you, yeah. I do, yeah.
I think a rebrand might work, but it has to coincide with
It's not just changing the name over the door. It's not just changing the name over the pub and going, here we go.
Yeah.
We're doing happy hours now. Like, you know, it's still in a place and it's associated with the place.
It's important to say that's what the OCI did.
Yeah. Yeah.
New board.
Yeah, it was a whole new thing. And I mean, listen, there's obvious, again, that example isn't perfect because the FAI presides over a structure with all leagues and affiliates coming into it. The OCI wouldn't really have that. It's member associations, you know, so it's not a like for like, but it's just the concept of it is not at all far-fetched now, because I mean, there are, as I said, and we say it again, there are good people in the FAI doing their best, trying to make things better. And for them, this stuff is a killer, because, you know, they're coming out, and I don't think that the FAI have struck the right tone with some of the stuff in recent weeks and months and with the AGM itself. And I can appreciate they've taken umbrage at some of the stuff from Shane Ross, and I agree with it, because I found some of the stuff from Shane Ross in the political interference a bit,
it's grandstanding.
Yeah, it's not like you're not the face of reform either, right? I get that. But this whole sense of, well, you know, the football family, well, we're going to look after it ourselves and so on. I just don't think that's going to wash with the public.
Do you know what's also frustrating? So, like, there's this piece, say, for instance, in the Sunday Times yesterday, which looks on the face of it like there are legitimate questions to be answered. There's now even no expectation that the FAI might move to clarify anything the next day. Now, I know there are ongoing investigations, but, like, even the notion that the FAI might comment on this.
The fact that they can't, it emphasises their weakness, and it emphasises the extent to which they're paralysed by these reviews that are hanging over them. Wow. And they are, like, I can understand why they are bound by certain legal restrictions or legal advice when it comes to commenting on certain things. But at the same time, like, I just don't know how they expect this to go away. You know, do they expect that, you know, that the games will come around next week and there's a couple of good results and all of a sudden, no, like, this is not something that's an easy fix. And I just think that the public perception of the FAI now, it's so damaged and the brand is probably so toxic that I find it very hard to see any form of light at the end of the tunnel in the foreseeable future.
Good. Okay, we'll move on.
That's an uplifting thought.
Some of the results from the weekend then, Dan, we'll get your hot takes before we move on to Brian Kerr. We've had Pat Nevin on already. I watched a bit of Aston Villa Everton. I know you would have been on League of Ireland duty. Villa Park was just fantastic. It was really amazing.
It's a great venue. Have you been? I don't know if you've been.
No, but, like,
I went when they were in the Championship.
Yeah, you hear great things about it. The red brick and under lights. You know, when Villa were getting relegated, it was a fairly miserable place for that season. Mm. The crowd did not like the team. The team were a bit nonplussed and not very good. Whereas on Friday, it was packed to the rafters. And Wesley, who'd been criticised in the opening couple of games, and people were wondering, is this guy good enough to score goals? It was really good.
Yeah.
Great movement. And, you know, he did this, like, there's nothing more frustrating than a striker who doesn't hold the ball up and give his teammates a chance to get into the game. He was brilliant.
Yeah.
And scored his goal, took it really well. I was a bit disappointed with Everton. They just kind of ran out of ideas, actually, a little bit against Villa. You know, Schneiderlin was very off. Neves, their midfielder, Gomez. At one point, Carragher said, like, this is Gomez's brother, because he was just that bad. He just couldn't pass the ball. Villa sat in and just Everton struggled. Just couldn't figure out what to do. But it was genuinely really enjoyable game.
But it's a great, like, I mean, I went to Villa a couple of times in the last couple of years when they were the Championship. And even a couple of years ago when they were having a dreadful season at home to Reading, like 30,000 people still there when they were 17th in the Championship. And, you know, it's one of those grounds that around it, a lot of old school, like, it's still, the ground obviously hasn't moved, you know, so it's a lot of the old businesses around the ground are inextricably linked with the club, you know, a couple of the pubs and the clubs and the social clubs or whatever, you know, it's like fathers going with their sons to the game type of thing, and it's a real
throwback.
The stadium has a bit more character to it than a lot of the more sanitised, the St Mary's of the world now, they're all the same, you know, like, it still has a bit of individual character. So, in that context, it's, like, great to have them back up. Mm. Probably better if Conor Hurahan was playing. I think from an Irish perspective, that's the only slight downside, that he started the season as a first choice and hasn't played since in terms of starting a match. But as a club generally, it's good to have them back.
Yeah. Chelsea, we touched on with Pat Nevin. Tammy Abraham scoring goals was nice. Manchester United were so pedestrian. I watched the Liverpool-Arsenal game. It was a really good game. And Liverpool looked great. You know, we touched on it with Pat earlier on, obviously. And then watched the, you know, Sky do a match of the day, hour-long highlights package of a game. They had the Man United-Crystal Palace one on. It was the closest I've come to when you're flicking between two football games as to when you watch a hurling match and then flick over and watch GAA afterwards.
Mm.
It's like someone just turned down the speed.
Different sport.
They're just so static. They all just kind of stand in the positions that they're named in. I know rotation is a bit of a buzzword. Whatever you want to use, movement. It's like you can spot the Manchester United formation almost within 20 seconds of watching any game.
In particular, that type of game, though. I mean, the thing was, the whole theory, and it's pretty obvious, we're repeating, like, stating the obvious, that this type of game was the test for them. Because actually, there was a moment, I don't know if in the second half, it might even have been leading to the penalty, where I think Palace were on the attack, and then Manchester had actually broke. I think it might have been leading to the penalty. Mm. And it was actually the one time where there was a bit of a chance for Manchester to use their speed on the counter in the break, and all of a sudden, they looked decent, because Palace had nearly got sucked out of their position as well. Mm. But otherwise, I think teams going to Old Trafford, and we've seen it over the last year or two, they don't necessarily fear going there too much.
It's kind of cool.
Actually, no, if you go there and you're disciplined and organised and stick to your plan, you'll get results, you'll get joy.
Well, there was a team that played them last year who had just come up from the Championship. I can't remember who had the quote, but absolutely, or else there was a player who'd played in the Championship and joined a new team, and they either got a draw or beat United, and he said afterwards, yeah, no, my teammates told me it'd be like this, that they'd move the ball really slowly and that we'd be fine. This was now the new perception, so it hasn't really changed. Liverpool-Arsenal, 3-1. Gary Neville's kind of point was that Arsenal, he's watched them there before and he's questioned their attitude, or he's felt they were incredibly naive in how they set up, whereas this was one of the first times in a while where he said, okay, it's just quality. It's not actually an attitude issue. He thought it was a good 3-1 win.
Like, they had their moments. Like, Pepe had that one break. Yeah. Like, they had opportunities, but
it was a tactic. It was a limited enough tactic. Mm. It kind of shows maybe the gap between the teams, that we're literally just going to sacrifice the wings in the hope that we get a 2-on-2 and Pepe does
it. Yeah, yeah, because there was a feeling that they might go with the three. They'd go with Pepe, Lacazette and Aubameyang, and they didn't do that because obviously they probably felt that would have been too bold.
Yeah.
So they were maybe caught in between two game plans and it left themselves open. I mean, Luiz did get himself, you can talk about what happened in the game and, analyse the gulf, but you also look at two big mistakes or two big incidents involving him, and that changes the perception of the scoreline completely.
Yeah, it does, 100%. And then we're going to hear from Brian Kerr on Newcastle's win over Spurs. Wolves and Burnley drew 1-0, and Man City beat Bournemouth. Silva playing in his 400th game. Graeme Souness saying maybe he's the best Premier League player ever.
Best Premier League player.
It's stretching it for me.
It's only a stretch, but like he's in the top 20, though, isn't he?
Yeah, which sounds not very much, but then when you start listing out the top 20, it's an incredible list to be
20.
On.
But I suppose how many Man City players are in the top 20? How many of the recent Man City league winners? Aguero has to be in it. Companies probably have to be in it. And to me, De Bruyne probably has to be in it.
If De Bruyne does it, I feel like De Bruyne has to do it for another season or two. There has to
maybe to get the all-time list.
There has to be a touch of longevity about what you do.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, these are the criteria that I'm inventing for my top 20.
Yeah, it's important that we heard them, though. Yeah.
But I did want to, I guess people would have seen a lot of the Premier League. For people who didn't see Barcelona 5, Real Betis 2, talk to me here. Ansu Fati is the second
16.
Youngest Premier League, or second youngest team player, first team player in Barcelona's history. 298 days, so 16 and 298 days. Came through La Mesa. He was born in Guinea-Bissau in October 2002. Moved to Spain when he was kind of 6 or 7. And his father was saying he came over here age 6 or 7. I'd come over before. I didn't even know, because his father had moved first and then the family followed. I didn't even know he played football, is what he was saying to Spanish radio station. Everyone told me I had no idea how good my son was, that he ran rings around everyone. And then he arrived and daddy realized this guy actually is very good. So he grew up in Seville and started with Sevilla. Word got out, both Real Madrid and Barcelona come knocking, as they do, when he was 9. Real Madrid offered more money, but they chose Barcelona. They came to my house, Barcelona, they convinced me, and that's kind of how he's come through. So what have we got in our hands here?
Well, he only came on for the last 10-15 minutes. He's a winger. He's extremely quick. He was a right-sided...
Is he technically good by any chance?
Yeah, he's a right winger who actually, he has a right foot, and so he's not cutting inside. So he actually...
Inverted winger.
He actually went outside at one point and drilled the ball
in the
post. He was great, a change of pace. Now, he was like...
Are you a get-to-the-end-line-and-whip-it-in type merchant?
You like the old school. Winger, don't
listen,
you?
There's a simplicity
brings back the memories. But the one thing about this game, Messi and Suarez are injured, so they're in the stands watching it. So after every Barcelona goal, they're 1-0 then at half time, or it's 1-0 just before half time, sorry. After every Barcelona goal, it goes to Messi and Suarez watching on, applauding, their kids sort of climbing over them. Mm. But it was Griezmann's day in the sun here. This was like.
Did Suarez have his little kettle or his little flask of whatever he liked?
I don't know.
That's South American tea.
I'm not sure if he did. Okay. But the moment of this game for a lot of people was Griezmann. I don't know if you've seen this.
The glitter.
Yeah. So, I mean, so Griezmann, obviously, before the game, way.
This, by the way, is the thin end of the wedge. This is now, we are going to be talking about this moment in 2 years' time when this kind of stuff has taken off.
Well, I think we've seen guys who've scored a goal before. Like Balotelli, we've had someone who recently, you had his phone for him. We should tell people what Griezmann did first, by the way.
Yes.
So he scores the goal, he runs over to the corner flag, and someone is there who has basically been waiting for the game with some glitter.
Yeah.
Red and blue glitter that they give to Griezmann, who then takes it, throws it up in the air, and it drops down over him like he's a Top of the Pops front man in the 80s.
The
right?
photos are good.
And it made for a great photograph. Yeah. And like again, you are thinking that it's not the first game of the season. It's okay, it's a home match. Like I just want to know how the discussion happens with the glitter man.
Unbelievable.
You know, like or who brings this up, you know?
I presume the glitter man was at the other end for the other half.
I'm guessing he was.
Yeah,
I'm
or maybe he's got four men in each corner.
I'm guessing he was. Maybe, I mean, no expense will be spared. Mm. Balotelli's one was he scored a goal and then he went on Instagram Live afterwards.
Yeah, that was
afterwards.
Good. No, that was
so he still had to go. He had to give someone his phone.
No joke getting 3G in the stadium either.
Yeah, but I'm guessing, like, did he give it to the guy with the passcode put in?
Or did they
take it off him? And no, but like even his key.
Well, it mightn't have been his phone. He just might have logged into Balotelli's account.
They still would have had to have his Instagram open. I can't imagine Balotelli I should have capitalised that. You know, like there's still.
Unless it was Face ID, new phones.
It could have been that. Yeah.
Either way, what the general reaction to Griezmann's display is?
New level.
The game is gone, and people of a certain age saying.
Yeah, but he also played well and did some brilliant stuff in the match. And there was a guy called Carlos Perez as well, who's come up from the B team, who he scored a classy goal as well. So there was some nice one touch football from Barca, and like this was like they were beaten in the first game of the season, and they were one down. So it was like you're thinking, oh God, this doesn't look fantastic here, but they still managed to turn it on for 20 minutes. Now, yeah. Betis will figure out what the levels will be. Like Dermot Corrigan was on last week, there is question marks around this Barcelona team now, and so obviously certain players are aging, and they're trying to manage this transition. Do they need Neymar? You know, all the stuff that's been part of the discussion over the winter, over the summer, sorry. You know?
A point Sid Lowe made, because I knew you were going to talk about this, and I didn't see the game, but you know, he was talking about the various issues when you have Messi and Suarez and Griezmann in the same team, and where does everyone fit? And geez, if Neymar comes, where do you fit everything even more so? But he was saying, with Griezmann leading the line and with those two on the bench, he was saying, so what did they see? Well, he said they saw Barcelona press high and hard in a way they hadn't for months. They saw brilliant goals and good news all over the pitch, not just Griezmann. Talked about Busquets and Sergi Roberto and Gerard Piqué playing very well. But the point was that Barcelona were able to press without Messi and Suarez in a way that they hadn't been with them. Now, I don't think Sid is suggesting that Messi or Suarez...
No, that's
Messi,
interesting,
Messi
though, yeah.
...in particular are not worth their place in the Barcelona team. But there are limitations, and you do have to fit a game plan around them. And with Griezmann, they could just press hard.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And I mean, they blitzed them after half-time. I mean, it felt like Betis just didn't get out of half for 15 minutes, and Barca scored 3 goals in that window.
Yeah.
So they were pretty dominant. But again, you know, it's a home match for Barcelona in the league. You know, Liga, like all the caveats apply in terms of what this really says about them.
Okay. Our football coverage is brought to you with thanks to Paddy Power. For more information on responsible gambling, visit Dunlewy, DUNLEWEY.net. We'll bring you some of what Brian Kerr was saying to us yesterday in a moment.
Christian Atsu finds Joel Linton. Chance inside the area for Joel Linton, who scores! Well, well, well. Totally against the run of play. Newcastle have gone in front, and it's their number 9, Joel Linton, with his first goal for the club. One touch, and then he side-footed a pass, Hugo Lloris, into the back of the net. It's Spurs 0, Newcastle 1, Joel Linton.
Now you're welcome back to the football show. Now we want to bring you some of what Brian Kerr was saying to us yesterday. Specifically, we get into some FAI stuff. He was reacting to the Sunday Times piece Dan and I have just been discussing. But first, Brian was in North London for Newcastle beating Spurs. We do have live commentary of the Premier League every Sunday here in Off the Ball. He watched Newcastle beat Spurs 1-0. Here was his take on the game at full time.
Well, Spurs had 80% of possession in the match. We expected Spurs to dominate the game. Suggestions that Newcastle's morale wasn't in great shape after the first two matches of the season. Lost to Arsenal, lost to Norwich 3-1, 1-0 at home to Arsenal wasn't so bad. That can be put aside now. There was no problem with the morale or discipline of the team today, or clarity about their roles, or had the manager prepared them well or not. Suggestions otherwise during the week made looks foolish by this performance. brilliantly disciplined, organised, well-drilled defensive performance, but also a threat in attack. Joe Linton, the new Brazilian centre-forward, took his goal superbly well, had a couple of other opportunities in the match, well helped by Atsu, particularly when he came on as sub on the left-hand side, and Almiron, the Paraguayan international right-hand side midfield, did a brilliant defensive job but also got up in attack. Spurs just hadn't got enough today, didn't happen for them, missing Dele Alli, setting on the new player, and Dembele, the expensive midfield player that got the goal against Aston Villa that got them back going that day, the 1-3-1, couldn't find a way to the goal. I made very few chances today. Big decision was the Harry Kane foul. For me it was a foul in the box by Lascelles. He started to stumble, he knew Kane was in, but he deliberately fell across on top of Kane, from my view of it. And Mike Dean, as the referees do now, they know they've a failed safe, that VAR's going to look at it anyway, so they don't make a decision. And he made no decision, just left it, waiting for the play to go on, went out for a throw in deep in the Spurs half, waited on the VAR to have a look at it and said no penalty. So not alone did he decide it wasn't a penalty, the VAR crowd decided it wasn't a penalty. For me, it was one other chance late on for Kane, and he missed. Scuffed the shot, cut back from Sissoko, but overall Newcastle deserved it. Brilliant defensive performance by them. It would have been one, I mean, you know, Nathan mentioned Benitez to me during the game, and it would have been a performance that the Benitez type team could pull off at times. But individually and collectively, they were excellent today. The whole back five, the work right in the middle with Hayden and Longstaff is exceptional, and the front fellas did well. Goalkeeper was rarely troubled in the match. Spurs had an off day by the standards that they'll expect here at this magnificent stadium.
So Mike Dean waves play on for the penalty and then doesn't go over to the touchline to look at the monitor. The Premier League and various dispatches have said they want to get away from that, the idea of the referee running over to look at a camera pitch side. So Anthony Taylor made the decision. We're quickly approaching the point where the referee is far less important than the man on VAR. He's now making all the key decisions in the game.
Yeah, that's it. Just seems to be the way. I mean, every goal is looked at by VAR to see what was there any error that the referee didn't see. I mean, and the one last week with Manchester City and Spurs was the extreme on it, when there was you would have to look at it. I certainly, it was maybe about the fourth time I look at it that I saw that it might have hit off the Manchester City's player arm, it was between Skip and I wasn't sure whether it hit the Spurs player or the Manchester City player, and it broke, and Jesus did his stuff and did his trick and turned and shot into net. And that one, there wasn't one Spurs player that appealed for a handball, but VAR found a way for to disallow the goal. I think that was extreme. That was, you know, and now, as I said to you, Mike Dean didn't make a decision today. He didn't even, you know, Mike Dean, where he can often be very demonstrative and waves his arms and that sort of stuff when he's definite about the decision. He didn't do anything when the incident happened between Lascelles and Harry Kane. He just let the play go on and waited, knowing. So that's the way it's gone now for referees. Michael Oliver, the best referee, would be the same. He'd go, well, I don't have to make a decision when it's in the box anymore. I can just do nothing and wait on the lads to tell me whether it's a penalty or not. And that's how it's gone. But look, at I don't know many angles they saw it from later on, but any angle I saw it from today, I thought it was a penalty kick. And I think Mike Dean, if he hadn't got VAR, I think he would have given a penalty. I think he was relying on them to make it, and as you said, they have an instruction now not to go and have a look at it unless they have to.
Yeah.
So there you go. But look, at Newcastle deserved it. We're I'd say they were good winners, but
well organised,
disciplined, and brilliant when they got their opportunity.
If you were to be brutal about it, would you look at Spurs now and say Pochettino has definitely taken this team as far as he's ever going to take them? Certainly in league terms, they might win a European Cup, I appreciate, but in general terms, are they progressing really under Pochettino now? He's done such a good job thus far.
I think we'll have to wait and see how the season settles down and the influence of Ndombele when he gets playing regularly, and Lo Celso when he comes into the team, and whether I think Sessegnon might be an improvement if he gets into the team at the full back position. has he taken as far as he can? I don't think so. I think he can continue. I mean, it'll be a difficult one, and one of the reasons he may have left out Eriksen today and in the first game was probably to say, well, we've got to get on with it. If we're not going to get have him, we might as well get used to it, and the supporters might as well get used to us not having him. So we've got to play other players and let them take on the mantle and do the things and let the team be as effective, not like, say, the Chelsea scene where everyone's saying, well, Eden Hazard goes, going to fall apart. Spurs have kind of seemed to be already adapted to the point of view where Eriksen's not going to be there. But I think he can still move this team on and bring them closer to Liverpool. Remembering the finance, a lot of finance has gone into the stadium and the preparations for the stadium over the last few years. They've gone and thrown a few quid at it, getting Endon Belle for up around whatever it was, 60 or 70 million. Not too much. Lo Celso was a loan player, assessing on relatively cheap. Not too much overspending there. Would have reaped a few quid back from the few sales. Janssen, they got decent money, I think 8 million from the Mexican team. Trippier, 20 million. So they got a few quid back along the way. So they haven't spent, but you know, they're a long way short of the quality Liverpool and particularly Manchester City have, and the options they have. And they, like, there seems to be an acceptance that they're going to sell a couple of players, or at least one or two players, before the window closes, which will again leave the squad quite tight. And the squad was tight last year. That's why the league form, they couldn't handle the European thing and the league form and end up losing 13 matches in the league, 20 matches altogether in the season. The squad wasn't good enough, and they're over reliance on the likes of Llorente and Janssen, even coming in at times and Kudo, who they've got off the books as well, to Besiktas now, and they let Dembele go last year. I think they'll be short again, but they're good enough to be in the top four.
Before you go, the FAI, not for the first or I suspect last time, is on the front pages of the news section. So the Sunday Times have the story once again, Mark Tighe and Paul Rowan. The headline, I appreciate there's lots of people who won't have even looked at papers today. FAI paid Giles Powell €300,000 for walk idea, is the headline. To try and sum this up for people, and then I'll get your thoughts. Basically, the FAI have paid Con Martin, he's a former League of Ireland player, about $60,000 a year, it seems, between 2011 and 2016. The issue, it seems, is that since 2016, Martin's been threatening to sue the FAI for further monies he alleges the association owe him. Basically, it's his contention that he owns the intellectual property rights and the copyright for this idea that he came up with, which was, through the John Giles Foundation, the Walk of Dreams, a concept, he says, as well, team kit wear, which combined all the club's purchasing power to secure discounts. And so he signed a contract with the FAI in 08 originally because he had run the John Giles Golf Classic for 8 years. Giles approved of him setting up the foundation. The FAI bought the foundation from Con Martin. So November 2016, there's an FAI board meeting. Martin says, and this is people talking at the board meeting, that Martin said he had been told by John Giles that the FAI had sold his Walk of Dreams concept to UEFA for €10 million, which is a hell of a price, I think everybody agrees, for this concept. Now, at the very end of the piece, they say, last night UEFA said that after an initial investigation, it couldn't find any record of this alleged agreement with the FAI. We're not sure if that €10 million appeared anywhere in the accounts. You suspect it would have caused a news story if it had before, but UEFA say they've no record of it. Con Martin's point is that I lost my head, he says, because I said that Delaney had the rights for Republic of Ireland only, but I had the intellectual property for the rest of the world. And then finally, to wrap up, the board back in November 2016, with all this going on, was told that the end game was to not give Martin any more money, but according to John Delaney, this would be hard to achieve and he was going to meet John Giles to discuss the issue. We don't know where that went or where that meeting went, and Con Martin says he may well still bring a case against them. But he was given €300,000 over those 5 years for the idea. I mean, has this €10 million from UEFA happened or not happened? I don't fully know. The John Giles Foundation, obviously under increased scrutiny now, Brian, you would have to say. So, yeah. I mean, here we go again. The latest in this drip effect.
Well, you know, a couple of things occurred to me. I don't know what Con Conmart, and I know Con going back. He was a great football man, a great football family. You know, Mick was a brilliant international player, and his dad and all that. And I know Con. I actually managed Con in a sense. And he played in the reserve team at Shelbourne at one time. I know him going back, and he did at one time approach me about some of these ideas or concepts, as they're referred to. One of them, he didn't want me to start a foundation, mind you. It was in relation to the idea of the kit purchasing and how good that could be an effective saving of finance for clubs. But this idea that Con, from what I read, understood that he owned the rights to the idea of having a walk, right? That seems a strange one to me. I heard your conversation earlier on with Kieran Cunningham and Kieran O'Rallick, and I agreed with what Ed says. That sounds, it sounds slightly illogical to me that anyone could own the concept of the idea of using, like, sponsored walks have been around since nearly I was in school, right? So how anyone would own the property, intellectual rights to that, and try to sell it to UEFA for 10 million, I don't understand that. But needless to say, we're unlikely to get an explanation or a clear or honest or straight explanation on that from people in the FAI in the immediate term, because, you know, while all these investigations are going under, are going on, we're not really getting any information from them now.
Once again, they refuse to comment.
So, but that sounds like a you said in there somewhere that there was minutes, quote in the minutes, that John Delaney seemed to be admitting that Con was due other money other than the 60,000 a year he was getting for organising some events, right? So that was obviously contractually he was entitled to that. It seems like a lot of money, but they must have agreed that he was going to do certain certain responsibilities and make them happen in order to be just that, to be justified. So until we get some detail of what the rest of it was, but it does appear from the quote you said from the minutes that what the object seemed to be that not to pay Con any more money,
that's the end game.
But John Delaney may have said
we have to.
So there's some
hard
other
to achieve. Hard to achieve.
Hard to
line,
achieve. Not paying. So it appears like there may have been some other contract or obligation in place, and it just appears to be another one of these things that not too many people knew about, but that he knew about. I know John Giles' name was mentioned in the headline on it, and I think that's a bit unfortunate given John's contribution to the game. And I would think from the start, the objective was honest and sincere in the idea of trying to help clubs raise money. From the start, and the first year was suggested that I saw the figure of 360 was raised. I don't know how much of that actually went back to the clubs, or whether Con's 60 grand a year came from that, or came from the FAI. Corpus. And that's what people who operate in the clubs will want to know.
Yeah.
Did the money they raised help to pay Con his annual fee or whatever it was? People be interested in that. And perhaps John might be able to explain that when I think he'll have his piece during the week with Nathan towards the night. But I know he's discussed this already in the past. I don't think Con Martin's name has come into those previous discussions. So maybe John can help people out. But I'm sure there was no intent on his part to mislead people or to misdirect any of the fundraising that he was involved in, that he wanted to see going towards the grassroots of the game. That's what I would say on that.
Yeah, the frustration is this piece just provokes more questions than answers, as you said, around the nature of the agreement. Did UEFA give it's ludicrous that we have to actually say, did UEFA give us 10 million?
Well, like, perhaps, the current, whatever its title, I think it's general manager, Noel Mooney in the FAI, who works for UEFA, maybe he'll be able to come up with an answer, because he seems to be very, very well up in the rankings or in connections in UEFA. We're not going to get a statement from John Delaney, I would think. But maybe Noel Mooney, who is, seems to be riding two horses at the moment, the FAI horse and the UEFA horse, he might be able to come up with an answer on that one. Can he find out fairly quickly from his sources in UEFA, did we get another 10 million for something else that we are surprised to hear? We were surprised to hear we got 5 million for not being the 34 team at the World Cup. So did we get another 10 million for presenting the idea of having a walk all around Europe for fundraising for clubs? I mean,
it's hard to know if we've done better out of the 5 million for handball or 10 million for a walk at this race. I mean, Jesus, it's just I think we're both in agreement. They need to come out and make this as clear as day, as quickly as possible.
The situation continues on at the moment where, you know, the other piece that was in the Times, one of the, I think it was four pieces, wonder about where Niall Quinn is, the report was that Niall wasn't interested in going forward as one of the four independent directors.
Yeah.
That he's annoyed at the idea of eight in-house people are still in-house, and that the president will be interviewing the people who are going to be the independent people, even though he's only temporary. And in most people's opinion, including mine, he should be well gone by now himself.
And the Minister for Sport's opinion.
He's going to be part of the recruitment of those four independent people, and also the Football Management Committee, which was supposed to be the group who are going to have the biggest influence on changes on the football side of the game, as we believe it. He is going to be the chairman of that group, and the vice president is going to be also on that group, on the Football Management Committee. The Football Management Committee, as I understand it, will be composed of 8 insiders in the FAI and 3 independent people, if those 8 deem it's necessary. Only if they deem it, those 8 inside people deem it. And that, to me, is totally illogical. That Football Management Committee should be football expertise on that, either football expertise on the administration side at a serious level. I don't mean FAI people that have worked in the AOL, Leinster Senior League, Munster Senior League, or a League of Ireland club. I mean someone who has worked at a serious level, or management at senior level of a professional, senior professional club at a high level, or coached at a high level, or played at a high level. Not a gang of the same as we had before of administrators who do great work organising fixtures and referees and match cards and disciplinary committees and all that stuff, but don't have the insight or the vision or the knowledge to put a new shape on the game for the future in Ireland on a football level. Let the other gang, their board and the people around that, do the business administration, all the ethical stuff that needed to be dealt with under the report and Aidan Morden's report. But the football side needs real attention, that the correct football decisions are made, not the mad one that they come up with, or that John Delaney or whoever come up with, to give Mick McCarthy the job on a temporary basis and name his successor, brilliant and all as Stephen Kenny may be as the manager in the future and has been as a League of Ireland manager in the past, name his successor before the first fella, Mick McCarthy, started in the job. I mean, that was ludicrous decision. And a proper football people at the top of it would not have made that decision.
Yeah. Right, we won't let it ruin our Sunday evening. I'll let you go. Thanks very much for that. Appreciate it.
Pleasure, Joe. Great stuff. Thank you.
And there you have it. Brian Kerr speaking to us yesterday evening. He was at Newcastle 1, Spurs 0 for us yesterday. Back in a sec.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Returning football shirts to the fans. Join the movement today by using hashtag SaveOurShirt.
Alrighty, so you're welcome back. Now we're pretty much done and dusted. Don't forget you can download all the best bits from this evening's show. We had Ronan O'Gara and Keith Wood trying to make sense of events at Twickenham. If you were looking for your fix of Pat Nevin this evening, he was on earlier on, 7:30. Podcast listeners, you would have heard that just now. And before I go, got to remind you, this Wednesday we're doing an All-Ireland Football Final special from St Vincent's. We're going to have Mossy Quinn, Pillar Caffrey, Mickey Whelan, Eamon Fennell, Andy Moran, and some other brilliant names on the night. It's completely sold out, but listen out for the highlights of the show across social channels. It'll be on offtheball.com later in the week. That's our All-Ireland preview night this Wednesday at St. Vincent's, with thanks to Super Value. And just to mark your card, by the way, Thursday 29th, we're doing a full takeover again on OTB Sports Radio, live from 7 a.m. all the way through until midnight. It'll be an All-Ireland final football special. And the way to hear any of that and all of that right through the day is to tune in to OTB Sports Radio on the Go Loud app, which you should download if you haven't already, or offtheball.com. Tomorrow night, we're going to have Darren O'Sullivan and Barry Cahill in studio reliving Dublin versus Kerry 2011 in the spirit of All-Ireland Final Week. We'll also have Rich Beam with us looking back over the PGA Tour season. Tom Dunn is on the way next. Good luck.
With guilt later.